I want to welcome you to this forum on bikes, cities, and the future of getting around. And at the outset, I wanted to thank our sponsoring partners. So first, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, which is really a leading advocate for sane, sensible, and sustainable transportation policy in the United States. We're going to hear soon from Jeanette Sadakan, who is the president of NACTO, in her spare time, the New York City Transportation Commissioner, and frankly, I think the main force behind tonight's event. Also, I want to thank the Washington Area Bike Association, a group whose work can be literally seen all over the capital city. We're here to celebrate. We're here to celebrate the publication of David Byrne's book, Bicycle Diaries. And after this event, there'll be signed copies available somewhere out there. Someone else will probably have to direct us directly to where it is. But I think this book provides us a platform for really exploring that special reinforcing relationship between cities and cycling. I went to the NACTO website last night, and it said quite plainly, bicycling is good for cities. It improves mobility, it enhances quality of life, it promotes public health, it reduces traffic congestion, it lowers greenhouse gas emissions. What's not to like, right? The reverse is also true. Cities are good for cycling. Cities are dense and compact. Cities are special and distinctive with their mix of form and their mix of uses and their mix of people, which enable even reward these kinds of alternative transportation. And this virtuous relationship between cities and cycling matters immensely for this moment. At Brookings, as in other places, we like to talk about this urban age where the first time in human history, more than half of the people around the globe live in cities. In the United States, obviously, that number is much higher, around 83-85% live in cities and metropolitan areas. And here and abroad, remaking our cities as dense and livable and cycling-friendly places is really no longer a marginal or peripheral or aesthetic act. This is the path towards healthy living. It's the path towards sustainability and social inclusion. And since density is often a proxy for innovation, this actually may be the kind of path for the kind of productive economic growth that's eluded our country for decades. In the coming months and years, as Jeanette and Earl will talk about, we're going to have a big debate in this town and around the country about the future of transportation policy. And I think the more we talk about cities and cycling, the more likely that transportation policy in this country, which for 60 years has been part of some kind of sprawl real estate road complex, will have renewed purpose and vision. And cities already, as Jeanette will talk about, are taking every step they can to reclaim their landscape for people, their downtowns, their waterfronts, their streets, their corridors, their parks. So we've got big issues to discuss today, from the local to the national to the global, from the pragmatic to the philosophical, and we've got the right panel to do it. On my far left, we've got Jeanette Sadakan, the New York City Transportation Commissioner. As many people in this room know, she's played major roles in this town during the Clinton administration, New York City government, in the private sector. What she's accomplished in her current job as the Transport Commissioner in a very short period of time is really quite remarkable. Whether it's the cycling effort, whether it's the Times Square effort, whether it's Rapid Bus, she is changing the landscape and pulse of that city. To her right, we have Earl Blumenauer, who is a member of the House of Representatives from Portland. He has been a long, great lead supporter of sustainable communities, both during his tenure in Portland government and obviously during his tenure in the House. He was for cycling before cycling was cool. I think you started the bike caucus, right, in the House? He knows better than anyone else in Congress how current transportation policies have tilted in the past towards roads, enhancing auto dependence, away from livability and placemaking. And he has the right committee assignments with Ways and Means and other critical committees that really join together, not just transportation policy, but critical issues like finance and budgeting. And to the congressman's right, we have our featured panelist today, David Byrne. Let me be brief. I think from the size of the crowd, I think everyone knows David. Really the leading force behind one of the most influential music groups in the world in the past several decades. One of my best little notes from Bicycle Diaries is when you talk about hearing hearing your song sung in karaoke bars in Manila, you know, which is one of these out-of-body experience. Doesn't really happen in the policy world as much, perhaps, in the music world. But obviously, maybe it should. I mean, this a task beyond this. Obviously, beyond the talking heads, his work with Brian Eno, his visual arts. What I loved about this book was really providing a cyclist's view of cities, of urbanity, of society, and how global it was. I mean, obviously, it focuses on many of the cities in the United States so many of us are familiar with, but then it took us abroad, and I think gave us a really fresh look at the rising nations and their mega cities. So this is the first time I've ever introduced a dual Grammy and Oscar Award winner, David Byrne.
Thank you.
This is where my parents live, in Columbia, Maryland. I didn't grow up there, but they moved there when I went to college. They're at an age now where they just recently realized they can't drive anymore. And like a lot of people in this country who live in similar communities, they're kind of stuck. There's a bus that goes from Columbia into D.C. in the morning, and I think there's one that comes back in the evening, and that's it for public transportation unless you want to get – I think there's a little shuttles within the Columbia town. But as far as – just if you don't drive, you're pretty much stranded out there, as a good part of this country will be stranded as they get older. Well, that's just a fact of life. But we'll hope something will happen about that. Here's some books that I read recently that some not so recently that I found inspiring. This one's called 20 Minutes in Manhattan. The writer Michael Sorkin is a little bit on his soapbox some of the time in this book. And he talks about the 20 minutes it takes him to walk to work and the various neighborhoods he passes through and how they got to be the way they are. And so he digresses a lot. This is a rather well-known book. This is The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs, who just passed away a few years ago. And it's a pretty amazing book. There's a chapter or two about zoning where I kind of glazed over a little bit. But some people in this town may find that a little easier going than I did. But other than that, she really had great insights. Not all of them completely intuitive. Some of the insights were, well, they've kind of become common knowledge now, that mixed use in a city is really important, that it's important to have to have neighborhoods that only do one thing for one part of the day means that the rest of the time, the other, whatever, 12 hours of the day, those neighborhoods are basically dead. It's good to have neighborhoods that do different things at different times in the day, that sort of thing. And then it kind of helps not just the business, but it helps the residential, it helps the businesses, all that stuff. Anyway. Here's another one. This is by a mathematician and architect called Christopher Alexander. I think he teaches in Berkeley. And he asked himself, how do kind of traditional people who make towns without architects, make their homes without architects, how do those work? How do they get to be the way they are? Is there a pattern that they follow? Is there, can we see any kind of structures that recur over and over again? And so he tried to discover over millennium what seems to be working. This is a city. It's high rises. This one is built by termites. It has, it's I think, in Australia. Holds many, many, many thousands. It has air conditioning. They build these things so that the warm air gets funneled out of the top. And so they maintain a constant temperature inside without burning any fossil fuels. And they angle them. They're kind of like airplane wing shaped. They're angled so that the direct heat of the sun doesn't hit the flat side. It hits the narrow side. So that helps them maintain the temperature. Something that we have yet to learn. This is downtown L.A., and you can imagine the heating, the cooling bill in all those glass buildings. So I'm going to go back, and how did we get that way? This is, I'm going to give a very quick, a lot of you know this, but sometimes it doesn't hurt to kind of go back over it. The last century, the 20th century, this in the beginning, this is, I think, in the 20s, an artist named Hugh Ferris did these beautiful drawings that imagined what our cities could look like. A little bit like Metropolis, the movie, and some other things. Huge, looming skyscrapers, like Dubai. I see a place that's been in the news these days. with broad avenues, with lots of cars in between, and no people, really, and no contact with one another. I don't know if you can see this. The one... Both of these drawings are by Frank Lloyd Wright, who a great architect, but thank God he didn't get to be a city planner, because this was his idea for Broadacre City, as he called it, and it was very broad. Farmland with a few tall skyscrapers interspersed here and there. Not very much in the way of urban life there. He did design us some little flying saucers for flying around in, which we don't have yet, but soon. This is another plan. This was by Buckminster Fuller. This is Buckminster Fuller's plan for Harlem, which is to house everybody in these giant cooling towers. So thank God he didn't get to do that. This is maybe the most famous of these utopian plans. This is Corbusier's idea for the Radiant City, which looks, of course, now to us, it looks like, oh, those are housing projects. But at the time that he did this, this was considered a utopian enlightened view because there was little green patches in the middle between the tall skyscrapers. But again, Corbusier was quoted as saying, we must kill the streets. He was not an advocate of urban street life. And if many more of these were built than were, he would have succeeded. This is the General Motors Pavilion at the 1939, I think, World's Fair. I think so. Futurama, maybe. Anyway, it was a giant model of very much like the preceding images of what a city could become. And General Motors at that time was, some of you may remember, the largest corporation in the world. It, not just in the United States, in the whole world. And so when they proposed an image like this, they had the muscle and the influence to see that everybody in the country and good part of the world knew about it and took it seriously and thought, yes, maybe that's what our city should be like. More like Dubai. So a lot of things like that happened. This is downtown Nashville. This is, more or less downtown Austin. I was just biking around, and this is kind of part of what you see. This is downtown Houston, Texas at 11 in the morning. There's one person on the street, maybe two. I think there's a second one. And around the corner was a little clump of people, and those were the smokers. That's downtown life in Houston. I'm not sure this where this is. It might be Indianapolis. It could be somewhere else. But a lot of our cities look like this. They're, half the city is given over to parking, whether in parking structures or parking lots, and this is dead acreage. There's no life takes place there, except if you're a car, if you consider a car a form of life, then. But as far as human life, it's dead acreage. And it kills the acreage, kills the life in the acreage that surrounds it as well. And when all that happens, you end up with like this. And I could have lots of pictures like this. This is downtown Cleveland. Part of it is boarded up. A lot of it is boarded up. And I hope we all find a way to help these places come back. But right now, that's where they're at. And I think some of that is not accidental. A lot of that is policy. This is what happens in downtown Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, it's a city devoted to business and trading, and there's very little in the way of civic values. There's no parks. There's no, certainly no bike lanes. Man, that was the worst. These are the maids, the Filipino maids who work for people in Hong Kong. Sunday is their day off, and because Hong Kong has no public plazas, parks, anything of that nature, they gather in the kind of subway underpasses and hang out together and have lunches and things like that. So it's a kind of the, you could say the culture, you could say the policy, but basically it's not conducive to being friendly to its citizens in that kind of way. This is in the United Kingdom, where I was biking along and I saw a sign that said, anything you say may be taken down and used as evidence. Yeah, so that made me feel welcome. Yep, it's us against them, sort of. This was another sign. This is for real. This is in the United Kingdom as well. If you can't see it, it says secure beneath the watchful eyes. And I felt safer. This is real. It looks like, you know, a 1984 type poster, and it is, but it's a real one. So to me, that means that you end up with a kind of urban situation, a life where the population feels like that the policymakers and those who control the city are basically against them, that it's everybody against everybody else. And it doesn't have to be that way. This is a plaza in a small town in Italy. Obviously, it's easy to take these kind of examples. This is a narrow little pedestrian street in Naples. It's lovely to walk in the daytime. I don't know if I'd want to be there at night. There's a little sound here. Yep, rickety sound. This is my bike cam. I'm just holding up my point and shoot. This is a small town, Ferrara in Italy. And cars are not banned from the town. There are cars in there. But it's sort of not very convenient for the cars. There were small winding streets and everything like that. So the cars tend to stay out of the center of the city. And everybody, grandma, kind of students, kids, everybody just gets around by bike. I just about got hit by a pigeon. This is Mexico City, where they close some of the streets in the center of the town for pedestrians during part of the day. This is Tokyo. This is Buenos Aires. It's just a lot of pedestrian life. This is Adams Morgan, some real estate. Adams Morgan at night, which is, I don't know if it's really, again, I would say, although it looks really lively, it's only lively at that time of day, that Adams Morgan, that corner in Adams Morgan. Okay. When I travel, I also take a bike. I live in New York, and I've used a bike to get around there, just run errands and stuff like that for about 30 years. And now I travel with bikes and get around different places. This is Charlottesville, Virginia. Passed by a little place that said, get in here, eat barbecue. And a few of us did. These are the whorehouses in Utrecht. They're floating whorehouses. They're kind of cute, and they have a sign that says, hold on to your child's hand. this is, I stumbled on a Kurdish rally in Hanover, Germany. This is a woman wearing Kurdish colors. This is a band that I saw on the corner of 7th Avenue and I think 54th Street in New York. They're a really bad band. But because I was on a bicycle, I just stopped and heard, listened, and you know, pulled out my little pocket camera. As some of us bike around, issues like bike parking become a thing. This is the Chinese solution. This is the Dutch solution, and it works. It works for them. I don't know how I would get my bike out of the middle of that, but they know how to do it. This is the New Zealand solution. You just hoist them up on the wall. This is Tokyo. There's a special little building in a very chic part of town, and you just pull your bike in there, and they have a place for you to park it. This is a guy outside Union Station here. He was bringing his bike to the bike station outside Union Station, a few blocks from here. I guess he was bringing his bike in, and it's pretty great. I haven't tried it yet, but it's a new thing for this city. This is in Portland, where they're doing a thing. Instead of putting in single bike racks on the sidewalk, they take over one or two parking spaces, and it accommodates a dozen bikes. And at first, some of the merchants objected and said, oh, I don't know if we want that thing. We might want somebody to be able to park in front of our place. And then they realized if one van parking in front of their place blocks their establishment, and they realized that with this, the view of their establishment is never blocked. So they said, no, we want more of them. Can we have? So now all the businesses want these. This is the Paris system, the Vélib system, and maybe you're going to talk about the other one, maybe? This
maybe.
Some bike lanes, besides parking, sometimes we need a bike lane to get if we're cycling around. This is New Jersey, where some of us decide to go visit the Edison Museum, and there really is no bike lane, and you have to end up riding on the highway, and it's pretty dangerous. I mean, this is really the only way to get from A to B. In Berlin, the bike lane is allied to the sidewalk, so it works pretty well. You don't have any feeling of that you're going to get hit. Jeanette has put in bike lanes in New York. This is 9th Avenue, and I think that might be Bleecker Street down below. Again, they feel they're very secure and you're protected, and even a kid could ride there and feel that they weren't going to suddenly get whacked by a door or a car pulling over. Riding bikes doesn't have to be expensive. You can make them yourself. This one's not very comfortable. And this, right, anybody can ride a bike. Any dummy can do it. That's it for me.
I'm not certain there's anything left to be said. That's not true. There are some things that are left to be said. Like, Bruce, when was cycling not cool? Work with us on this.
I'm talking about the truckers.
Okay. I am pleased to have a chance to spend a few minutes this evening sort of sitting between two celebrities here on the stage. I think one of the things that we ought to do, and those of you who know that we gather in Washington, D.C. to talk about public policy and cycling, tend to begin these gatherings by reciting the Universalist cyclist question. Some of you know what it is. Repeat it. How many people right this moment are stuck in traffic on their way to ride a stationary bike in a health club? Let's try that again. How many people are stuck in traffic on their way to ride a stationary bike in a health club? That used to be funny. But actually, it is, I think, a very real-life example of why what we were talking about 20 or 30 or 40 years ago about cycling was a good thing. It was interesting. It was curious. It was amusing in its own way. But it's gone from something that was good and desirable to something that was important and then urgent and now, I think, critical. Bruce mentioned I've spent much of my early career working as an elected official in Portland with the goal of making my hometown America's best European city. It wasn't actually so hard in terms of knowing what to do as it was convincing people that that is what we should do and that it would be effective. Luckily, over the course of the last 30 years, we're finding out that it does, in fact, work, and people are more comfortable with it, and that it has helped define our community in interesting ways, and it leads to a broader livability agenda. The cyclist is just, I think, the most important indicator species of a livable community, where you can cycle safely. This is a place where children can actually get to school on their own without creating another traffic pattern of traffic jams. And you are less likely to be concerned about morbidly obese 400-pound sixth graders. Cycling is an opportunity for people to be able to enjoy the streetscape that was just so marvelously portrayed. This is serious business because we're moving from an era, and I grew up in that Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver sort of geezer baby boomer early years, where the majority of families actually had children. By the turn of the century, the majority of households in this country there'll be more single-person households than families with children. And these aging geezer baby boomers are going to care about things like being able to walk to the store, to be able to access the streetscape. This is something that, and I appreciate this slide about Portland, Oregon. There was a time when people got quite cranky with bike lanes and having bike parking. But now, as David mentioned, there are people who are requesting the removal. That bookstore, that pub, that restaurant, they can accommodate 25 consumers in exchange for two cars. It's not a hard trade-off. We're also being able to illustrate that this is not some flight of fancy and is something that has to cost us a lot of time and money and sort of detract from our vision of an economic future. Remember those businesses that are requesting the removal of on-street parking. But we've created in our community a bike culture. There are approximately 1,000 people in our little town that are employed in the bicycle industry. It's $100 million a year of economic activity. Over 4,000 bicycle events a year. I think it's one every 23 seconds. There's lots for charity. Some has economic. There are probably fewer commercial applications for our several thousand person naked bike ride. But they are all part of a rich mixture of activities in a vital community that is self-reinforcing. It's also part of a design to give people choices about how they move. Now, contrary to what some people say, we haven't declared war on the car in Portland. But we've made a decision we're not going to surrender to it. And that has made a profound difference in terms of the ability of people to have the quality of life they want. Because Portlanders drive more than 30% less than people in Houston, where we saw that great vision of this empty street, we spend $2,500 a year less per family than the national average, and much more than Houston. That's $2,500 that can be spent on food in those pubs and restaurants, or books, or health care, or education, or housing, or travel. And it is money that recirculates in the community, unlike auto expenses that end up in Detroit or Japan or Houston or Kuwait or Hugo Chavez's backyard. This is money that stays and circulates. But most important, I think it's a sense of regaining control, which I think a lot of us are concerned about in an era of strange economics, concern about the future of the planet, and being able to exercise this makes a difference. We would ask that there's a takeaway this evening that you help us agitate for the federal policies that will help Jeanette expand her vision and that of Mayor Bloomberg in a dramatic way. We want to make this next Surface Transportation Act something that is a quantum increase. We want to complete safe routes to schools, so it includes high schools. We want green routes to work. We want to have where we will be able to give communities multi-year grants to be able to deal comprehensively with the bike and the pedestrian, the land use issues. And last but not least, I went out on a limb this year at the bike summit because I was just frankly hacked off, taking my life in my hands, cycling from the Capitol. I made a decision 13 years ago to bring a bike instead of a car to Washington, D.C. I bike here every day, but you're taking your life in your hands on America's arguably one of its grandest, most famous streets. So we went on a limb and said, why can't we have bike lanes on Pennsylvania Avenue before the bike summit coming up in 3 months? And I'll tell you, the new administration, the city of the District of Columbia, are going great guns. There's exciting things going on. This is a vision that can happen. Right, Gabe? I mean, this guy's terrific. But it is an example of what we can do in every community in this country. We increased our bike mode split in Portland 400% for the cost of 1 mile of freeway. This is within our capacity. We can do it on Capitol Hill helping you. And the vision and energy in this room, I think, can carry this to every community in the country. Thank you very much.
Wow, that was great. I believe in all of the visions that were laid out here today. I think, actually, as Earl said, there's almost nothing left to say at this point. We do have a rock star panel, and I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, the work that Bruce is doing, the work that David's doing, the work that Earl is doing. Everybody's doing as much as they can to bring an urban agenda to the table that makes our cities work. And I think that's what all of us are here to do today. And one of the things that we've been working on in New York City, as you've probably heard, is what we can do to make our city work better for bicycling. And that's a struggle that many cities are working on right now. And I am working with the National Association of City Transportation Officials, which is a loose federation of transportation officials in all the big cities in the country that have come together to say we need another urban agenda and we need to raise the profile of the critical issues that our country faces. We are the economic engine of this country, and we need to do a much better job of getting the kinds of investments that we need to make our cities work. And so one of the first steps that we're doing this year is launching a new Cities for Cycling initiative, which we are launching here with all of you tonight, and it is going to be taking our cities to a whole new level. So I'm going to describe that initiative in a moment, but I first want to put it into a little context. As David mentioned, how we get around cities, as you saw, how people move, how they live, really has an effect on how our cities are shaped and how they feel. And the good news is that our cities are thriving again, and or they were at least until about a year ago. And even in the downturn, I think that many central cities are thriving versus doing much better than what you're seeing on the fringe of our metropolitan areas. And in fact, prior to 2008, I couldn't go more than a block or two in New York City or in Washington, D.C. without coming across multiple construction sites. And cities have really become the place to be, the place to raise a family, the place to start a business, to invest. And I think New York is really a stark illustration of that trend. We lost a million people in the 70s. We've largely then regained those million people. And right now, we've come back. Our population is at an all-time high of 8.3 million people, and we're forecast to see significant growth over the next 20 years. Bruce and his team at Brookings have done a really good job underscoring where we are, how we are growing today. We've entered an urban age. We've become a metropolitan-focused country, and that trend will only continue, as you can see. And that's great news. But as we've become a metropolitan country, we are still working with federal policies that date back to the 1950s. In fact, nothing has changed except for how we've grown. So the fact that we're growing this way is great news for cities, and it's great news for sustainability. But the intense economic activity in cities and the demographic dynamism that we're seeing, all these different people coming into cities, requires that we continually invest and renew in our infrastructure just to keep things moving. And you can see we've really run up against the barriers to growth right now. I mean, you're jammed 24/7. You know, in New York City right now, you know, just to get across town is an adventure. You can walk across town faster than you can take the bus. You know, my traffic commissioner says the only way to get across town in New York City is to be born there. So that's really what we're up against in terms of the limit of our growth. So I think that's why cities are focusing really hard on sustainability initiatives to point the way forward. Mayor Bloomberg's launched Plan YC. Chicago's got its 2030 plan. Houston's got a freight plan. And Seattle's got a great pedestrian master plan. I mean, all of these are recognizing the imperative that we have to do things differently, you know, as we look at a hotter planet. And that's the key to economic competitiveness for the 21st century. And that's why you're seeing projects like LA's Orange Line. That's why you're seeing the pedestrianization of Times Square in New York. That's why you're seeing, you know, development-oriented streetcar lines in Portland. You know, they're all coming from this intense understanding. But these are only local initiatives, and there is no federal strategy or framework beyond Earl Blumenauer. And that's a great strategy, but we need to do more. And so, you know, we need to push to have the resources to get the kinds of cities that we want to get done, and to have the kind of systems that we want to have in place done. And so the innovations in these cities are happening despite federal policy. And, you know, where federal money is used, I'm sure there are lots of people in this room that know that, you know, it involves wading through mountains of red tape to get these projects done, and just incredible checklists, the checklist to get a bike lane in is insane. You know that we have to go through air quality conformity to see if a bike lane should be put in. It's sort of, you know, that your state DOT will have to check to see if this little bike lane that you're putting in, you know, makes sense versus the local folks. So there are some changes that we need to get done, and Earl's going to make them all happen. there you go. So what about biking? It's really the low hanging fruit. Oh, this is San Francisco. This is the good story is that San Francisco's bike system has come out of legal purgatory, and actually to mark that occasion, that's actually Mayor Newsom and MTA head Nat Ford, and they are rolling out the first bike box out there. It was really exciting. And, you know, bike networks are relatively easy to put in, and they're inexpensive, certainly next to improving or expanding public transit networks or trying something crazy like congestion pricing. So there's a lot of there are a lot of projects that cities are really well underway in implementing a lot of great programs. Chicago's bike plan calls for 5% of bike trips, the 5% of short trips in the city to be made by bike by 2015. And Seattle has committed to triple the amount of cycling by 2017. New York, we're going to triple it by 2015. From 2007 levels, we put in 200 miles of on-street lanes. And yes, we are exploring, a bike share system in New York. We think that yellow checkered bikes should take their place next to yellow checkered cabs. That's our strategy. And Portland is in the process of adopting a new comprehensive bike plan. In fact, I just learned today at our Cycling for Cities meeting that they expect to have a 25% bike share by 2030. So there are some really great, ambitious goals out there. You're starting to see these cities look like they should. And you take a look at the how cyclists are responding. This is rush hour in Philadelphia. You're starting to see the same thing in Chicago, in Portland, in Brooklyn, in Baltimore. But doing this, as I've mentioned, isn't easy. And there are many institutions, institutional barriers and funding barriers. There are no national street designs that accommodate best practices in biking. And the most innovative work that we see done out there is really done experimentally, really sort of under the radar screen. My favorite five-letter word in New York City is pilot. I do a lot of pilot programs in New York City. But, you know, the design issues aside, getting the federal funding in some instances is even harder than it is to get these bike lanes into different neighborhoods. And some of the most celebrated and popular new facilities are not even in any national guidelines. And so our new protected bike lane in Broadway and Midtown generated a 46% increase in cycling just in the second half of this year alone. So the designs are spreading. You can see them in Portland. This is a great design, similar design in Washington, D.C., thanks to Gabe. And it's in demand. Yeah, Gabe. And, you know, these designs are in demand from coast to coast. And so, but it's difficult to get them done. Even simple things like colored lane or advanced stop, you know, bike boxes, you know, are not in any guidelines. And so too with bike signals. There's no provision for that. And even bike boulevard markings, and signage isn't there. So that's why NACDO and its member cities and our partners at SRAM Corporation and Bikes Belong have launched Cities for Cycling to help the rest of the country with some of these best practices and new designs for biking. And while it's a project of NACDO, which is basically working with large cities, we're also going to be working with smaller cities that have a huge interest and have done a great amount of work in this arena, cities from Cambridge to Boulder to Berkeley to Madison, you know, and other cities that are involved. And so today we are launching the Cities for Cycling initiative, and this is our website. You should go to citiesforcycling.org and check it out. And our first feature is actually a compilation of the emerging innovations in cities. And we think it will go a long way to help the discussion and get the wheel turning in these cities. So next year we're going to be holding a series of workshops around the country synthesizing our best practices. And our goal, really, is to take these best practices and actually turn them into a new MUTCD. If you don't know what that means, stay away from it. But we're going to do a 21st century one that really actually works for cities and is not designed for highways, but is designed for cities, people-oriented places. And we're going to also continue our work double the amount of funding for bike and walk programs and streamlining the federal process. We think this is all doable, especially since livable communities is our Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood's priority. And we've seen some state DOTs actually moving in that direction. I recently read that the Texas Transportation Commission, not one of the more progressive agencies that I had heard, but they actually recently adopted ITE's manual for walkable urban thoroughfares. So as the song goes, if you can reform transportation policy in Texas, you can do it anywhere. It's the title of David Byrne's new track. But if you think about it, extending our bike networks is a matter of customer service, really. People want to ride bikes, and what we've seen in New York is if you make it safe for them, they will come. And so in New York, they're coming in droves. You know, cities are seeing safety benefits of increased cycling in lots of different dimensions. It's cycling, putting in bike lanes is not just about putting in lanes for cyclists, wonderful that is, as that is. It is about a transformative change to cities. It improves the safety dramatically, improves the livability, the look, the feel of cities. And so it's in everybody's interest to get cycling embedded into the heart of our urban metropolitan areas. So stay tuned. That's a little bit about what's going on with NACTO and Cycling for Cities. There's much more to come in the year ahead, and I look forward to working with all of you to get this done. Thank you.
So we're going to take some questions, which means everyone's got to get mic'd. Is anyone mic'd? Okay, well, while they're miking, I'll ramble for a bit. So it sounds real good, right? And it sounds like if the old mantra was build it, they will come, the new mantra is remake cities, they will bike. And I would like maybe Earl to start. What's the opposition to this? Right, because it sounds like we've got a mix of stupid rules that goes back decades. I mean, we're applying things that obviously shouldn't apply to this stuff. We've got a lack of resources, perhaps, to identify the innovations and diffuse them rapidly and all that kind of stuff that the federal government used to do. This may be before a lot of people were born in this room. There's a mix of what seems to be low-hanging fruit. But where's the opposition to do what we're describing here at a grand scale?
I think that there is actually not much opposition per se. We have a majority of members of Congress who are part of that bike caucus. We've watched the cycling and pedestrian investments go up rather dramatically compared to other areas. There are, I think, three factors that are at work. One, frankly, is that we do have a lot of this overhang, and there are people that are nervous about change. And we have so much that is embedded that is stupid and cumbersome. And there are, I think, interests in the part of some people for grander reform, and this is kind of as bait. The second problem, I think, is the dysfunctionality of our political process. We suffer because grown-ups can't work very well together. Some of you read my little essay, My Near-Death Panel Experience, in the Times a couple weeks ago, where we had something that was actually simple and common sense that everybody supported that morphed into weapons of mass destruction. And so we get caught a little bit in this. But I will say that I think the most important impediment is just sort of unleashing the forces of people who care about cycling. I think we've seen an evolution of the folks that are there, But I don't think we've scratched the surface.
Right.
And people like Gabe need to have the forces come, people not just being cranky, but people who are out there running interference with some neighborhoods, people who are out there pushing with the city council to make sure that there are these minor adjustments. There are people who are making it an issue every time there's a serious and unnecessary accident. I think we as cycling advocates have been a little too accepting. We've been spending more time cycling and less time agitating. And I think that needs to happen to provide Gabe and Janine with that potential force.
I have an image of cycling and agitating at the same time, but that's it's getting me a little worried. Jeanette, is there opposition, or Gabe, if you want to speak?
Well, I think I think that Earl captured it at the national level. I think that change at the local level is always hard. It's, you know, you fight it one parking space at a time, and so, you know, when you are putting in when you're changing a street network to build in 21st century forms of mobility, whether they be, you know, bus rapid transit lines or a cycling network, you are changing the way that the street network works. And so for 50 years, we prioritized that street network for cars. And so to take that back and say, we're going to prioritize our streets for people, while it's obviously in the long-term interest, in the short-term interest of a city to do, it can be very difficult to go up against some of the parking interests and some more traditional folks who sort of look at this as a, you know, highly radical form. Some people look at the New York City Department of Transportation. We've been called the Department of Parking Space Removal because we are working to actually bring better balance to our street network. We can't triple deck our street network. We have to build in better ways for people to get around, and we have to make it easier for people to get around, and we have to make it more attractive for people to get around. We can't wish people onto buses, and we can't wish people onto bikes, but we can build the kind of network that makes them want to get on that. But it is one street at a time.
David, actually, Gabe, why don't you respond to this as well?
I just wanted to...
Hello? Well, come on up.
I'll just concur with Jeanette. You know, I think that here we go. It's important to not feel like we're out of the mainstream if we want to do something a little bit different. It's not really that different. We're talking about taking the streets back and being sensible and balancing our network. And we have made a lot of mistakes over the last 50 years, and we're trying to undo a lot of those mistakes. In D.C.'s case, we're trying to bring 200,000 residents back to the city. And so we have to make it a balanced, more livable place. So I think, you know, one of the points that Earl made is very important, and that is that the influence that people in this room have is more than you might think. You know, if five people email a council member about a bike lane, they'll turn on a dime and support that bike lane that they may have not supported before. It's all about numbers. So if you have things that you believe in, I would encourage you to stand up and talk about it. I think that's hugely important. And for the people that run the city to understand this is not outside of the mainstream, that this is the mainstream. And it's time to stop sort of seeing ourselves as outside of the mainstream.
We have time for questions while people are formulating. And we have a mic here. So I want to open it up, and then I'll come back at the end. Oh, right over here. Back over here. Perfect.
I want to talk about bicycle infrastructure in a little more broad sense. I think New York City, you know, the country's most wonderful city, has a unique issue with infrastructure, a little bit different. It's than most other places. I think it's just too many cars. And the bike lanes really are to address that problem without addressing directly there in that setting. And it may work. It may be what you have to do. In presentations that I've attended on the topic of bicycling, which I come to with a bike, I rarely encounter a situation where I'm not hassled about bike parking. And, you know, this is infrastructure that makes a statement. It is a statement about being middle class, about being invited and a welcome guest. And it says that to all the people who drove to that event. as well as the people who biked. So at Brookings, I would like to be able to come there in 3 months and see bicycle parking at Brookings.
That's a good idea. That's a great idea.
And have on the glass wall at the entrance the no bicycles allowed taken off. I lost a bicycle on the street at a Brookings event. And
this is at the, part of the guerrilla movement within the institution.
And at the museum, I would like to see bicycle parking on the street, permanent bicycle parking, not that wonderful parking provided by WABA on a temporary basis, but parking that reflects the architecture of the building. Right. And I think that that kind of emphasis, that's where the low-hanging fruit is. I think relative speeds of cars and auto traffic with bicycle traffic is a more pertinent issue about bicycle safety on the streets. Thank you.
I think you've raised two different questions, right? I think you've raised one question about New York versus other cities because of density and landscape and streetscape. The second question is really about this bike infrastructure. When people buy this book, which you should, in the back, what David does is he has a series of designs about bike racks for New York City, which I gather have been installed mm-hmm. in many parts. So what I might ask him to do, we'll pay you for this, is design one for a think tank. So it might be like a light bulb or something, but Jeanette, why don't you begin to...
Well, you raise a really key point. And in fact, what we found, we did some research in New York, our Department of City Planning did a report which found out that the number one reason that people did not bike to work was the lack of indoor bike parking. And, you know, New York City is one of the safest cities in the world. But still, New Yorkers were reluctant to park their bikes on the streets of New York for 8 hours and expect that they'd be there. And so in response, Mayor Bloomberg just signed into law a brand new piece of legislation, a brand new law that takes effect December 11th, and it mandates that commercial office buildings with freight elevators have to provide bike parking, indoor bike parking, if tenants request it. And so it is the most sweeping... It's the most sweeping bike legislation in the country, and we think it's going to make a huge difference. So that's, I think, a really important piece. We've tripled the number of on-street bike racks, you know, that we've got out there. We've got some 6,200 bike racks. But, again, it doesn't get to that, the security piece, which is a big issue. And I do urge all of you in this room to look to the David Byrne bike racks because it shows that it doesn't have to be grim. You know, bike parking can be fun. So,
David, when you've... Just to answer this question about the difference between New York and other cities, I mean, you've biked throughout the U.S. and across the globe. How do you think about that difference between what is clearly the most dense city in the United States versus the Houstons that you showed or the Detroits and so forth?
Yeah, the question isn't so much, there's certain cities where you can see, oh, this is easy. You just lay it out and do the stuff and it'll fill up in a minute.
Right.
Other cities like whatever, Houston, Dallas, Phoenix, you name it, there's a lot of them. You wonder, okay, the core of the city on some of those cities is kind of hurting. And so you can't expect a huge kind of 20, 30 mile wide array of bike lanes. That's just not going to work overnight. I would think get something in the core, get something in some of the other little nodes that happen in where people actually do congregate and get around and provide some kind of transportation between those and then let things kind of develop. As Earl said, that when some of this kind of transportation problems are fixed, it really is good for business. And it kind of starts to revitalize the centers and these nodes around some of these towns that are really hurting.
That's great. I've got a question right over here. Maybe two over here and then one back.
Thank you. So the congressman, the legislation that you've been proposing and been writing over the years and the advocacy is really very well appreciated, but it's geared towards local and state governments. I'm a federal employee here in Washington, and there seems to be no requirement or no interest in the federal government in building facilities or providing facilities other than what we've been able to scrounge in our office buildings and dumpster diving to be able to get racks. and other facilities. And I'm kind of curious to know, since the government workforce is tremendous here, obviously,
absolutely,
and it is unique to Washington. It brings, you know, and you want to support DDOT's efforts here to have people ride their bikes. There's no subsidies. There is transportation subsidies for other methods, alternative methods of transportation, metro, van pools. There isn't for bicycling. There's no money in any legislation that I've seen, and maybe I'm wrong, to provide for federal agencies, so that federal agencies can provide facilities for alternative means of transportation. I'm very curious to know what your perspective is on that and how we can, those of us in the federal workforce, can push that agenda, because the numbers are tremendous.
Absolutely. And probably the hidden secret weapon in terms of accelerating these changes is for the federal government to model the behavior that it expects from the rest of America. We have 300 million square feet of office space in 60 portfolios of a million or more. We've had this conversation with Gabe and with his predecessor, Dan Taglarini. There is no comprehensive federal parking policy. Every agency does its own. Some have free parking. If we had a uniform transportation benefit and allowed the workers to figure out what they were going to do with it, if there was federal compliance with an overall parking strategy for the city, we're having these conversations. In fact, there is an effort underway for the Department of Treasury to start complying with what we've done in the legislation we got passed last year for the transportation benefit for cycling, to see if it can actually be administered by the federal government through Treasury. We think that's a great idea before we expand it. We're planning on having this conversation with GSA in terms of application. And tomorrow morning with Sean Donovan, our Livable Communities Task Force is going to start the conversation with that we've had with Ray, with EPA, that the people who are part of this livability initiative, that they work with us so that the federal government leads by example. It shouldn't be expensive. In fact, done right, it probably will have no cost. We just reallocate how it's done.
The first step is to strengthen by 100% the transportation element and the federal element of the DC comp plan. It's so weak. Same thing with GSA transportation demand management planning. It's so weak. And I've been complaining about this for 5 years. Nobody says anything, does anything, or listens. But what I was going to say is, for 20 years I bicycled, for 10 years I've been an advocate, now I'm a county planner near Baltimore, and it's all about the roads, in the DPWs, in the DOTs. And so our Office of Planning doesn't even know when the county DPW does something or if they do something, and we hear from citizens. And so there's some, it took 50 years to get to where we are, and it's going to take at least 20 to 40, just like it took Copenhagen 40 years to get to where they are today. As long as we want it all to happen tomorrow, we're definitely going to fail. But thank you, New York City. Thank you, Portland, because you show the way for the rest of us.
We've got one over here. We may want to talk about timing in a second. Yep.
Talk about preaching to the choir. I mean, this all sounds wonderful, but the reality is that most American adults do not ride a bicycle and have never ridden a bicycle for transportation from point A to point B. I think it's worth spending a little bit of time thinking about how we change that. One way that we might go about doing that is recognizing that the baby boom isn't getting any younger, and some folks may be able to do that commute with an electrically assisted bicycle that they couldn't do with their own feet exclusively. Something like a quarter of all bicycles sold in Holland now are electrically assisted bicycles. I'd love to see if we can try to incorporate that into our planning and get the broadest range of potential cyclists out of their cars and onto the road. Thank you.
So is America ready to bike? I mean, how do we think about the different demographic substrata? I mean,
I think America's ready to bike. I think if you, but I think the big important caveat is you have to make it safe for them to bike. You have to feel like it's safe to bike if you're 7 years old or 70 years old. And that's not the way the networks are generally developed, or they are in very select areas. And so we really need to focus on building that kind of a safe network so that people feel okay about taking their families and getting out there. I really do look at families as the indicator species of as to whether or not our bike lanes are working. When I see families out there, I feel like that's an indication that that's the kind of network that is a success. So I think that that's a really important component of it. You note, yes, we do have an aging population. It's an issue that we really do need to work on, and we need to sort of also create communities and do land use planning so that we're making it easier for people to walk around and get around without having to have a car, which is a whole nother discussion, but I think a really important one. But I think that electric bikes are a positive move in that direction as well. Maybe that's going to be Bruce's industrial policy moving forward at the next Brookings Forum. Who knows?
But this is
better with consistent national policy on that score. In New York State, electrically assisted bicycles are illegal on the roadway.
We're part of
it. Unfortunately, not here.
I think the momentum that is being built and how we're being able to see the difference it makes in terms of people getting a little help from New York, but it is cumulative in nature, and I think the momentum builds dramatically. People are ready to bike. Part of it is facilities. Part of it is seeing. Part of it is getting back and training again. The safe routes to schools, I think, is absolutely essential to have a generation that is raised and trained. Because it is getting to be, for some people, Bruce, it was always cool, but for right. more people now, it is becoming more cool. And I see this as part of what's happening with the cumulative efforts that are going on here. I think people are going to be stunned at how fast this accelerates yeah. with all of these little pieces yeah. that are available, whether it's electric bikes or it's bike lanes or it's more parking, or it's bike tourism. The whole rush here, I think you're going to be stunned at what happens in the next 10 years.
We're going to come back to this behavior bit. Keep moving back. There was a woman here who had her hand up from the very beginning, right over there, and then we'll get some.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to commend you guys for not only being here, but also bringing up the issue of land use. I'm an architect, urban designer, practicing here in the city. And as president of CNUDC, it is critical that we start folding in these land use factors and the placemaking, the fact that streets are public spaces. They're not just thoroughfares for vehicles. But also, I would like to sort of throw something out there to keep in mind, in as much as educating drivers. I think a lot of this, while there is starting to be a groundswell of the bicycle riders and understanding how to make these things happen, I bet if we went to a meeting similar for public transportation officials, we'd be hearing some of the same issues. They unfortunately have more backing than us peds or bicyclists do. But I'd like to, especially Representative Blumenauer and Jeanette, somewhat in New York City, is in that planning and in that thinking, how do we educate up-and-coming future drivers, obviously all of us that have awareness for the multimodal issues are going to employ it anyway, but I think there needs to be a larger education campaign.
I think that's a really important point. We've done a big marketing campaign in New York, the Look campaign, to encourage people to look out, literally look out for one another on the streets of New York. And we have a pretty vivid campaign about what happens if you don't, and sort of treating cyclists, looking at cyclist body as if it's a motorist body. And we need to do a lot more to have people understand that there are multiple people, lots of different users on the streets. And so the public education piece is part of it. When I was in Copenhagen, I was really struck. I was talking to Jan Gehl, who's the chief planner there, and he was telling me that when they do their driver education, they actually teach drivers when they open their car doors to use their right hand to open the car door so that they're forced to turn. And so you literally look out, you know, your back to look out for cyclists. And so it can be little things like that that I think we need to move toward, and it can be public education campaigns. And I also think that there's going to be safety in numbers. We're not quite at the tipping point yet, but we're going to get to the point where it's going to be a much more regular piece and people are going to get used to that interplay on the streets.
It could be a full employment act for chiropractors, but I'll leave that for a second. I've got one back here, a few back here. Right back there. So we're just trying to get a mix of the room.
I'd like to ask a question about the future. When we think about our cities 10, 20 years from now being more bike-friendly, how much of that is exclusive bikeways? How does it fit into... Earl might comment on the bicycle boulevards and the side streets in Portland. What is the pattern that would be the goal, eventually, of a more bike-friendly American city landscape?
I feel very strongly that it is using the whole mix in the toolkit. There are some parts of our residential neighborhoods where the bike boulevards that have limited access to cut down through traffic, that have traffic islands and speed bumps that make it very comfortable for the cycling family. In other places, it makes sense to, in terms of cost and in terms of the travel demand, to have it totally separated. What I find exciting at this point is looking at all the things that are in the toolkit from Jeanette's organization, where you can deal with a particular neighborhood and be able to design things that are cost effective and that give people the desired outcome. I don't think there is one cookie cutter solution by a long shot. I think in some cases it's closing streets off to cars. In other cases it's integrating it in, some of it separated. All of it is the most sensible application for what the community is comfortable with and what gives the desired outcome. But there's more in that toolkit now than we've ever seen, and I think there's an appropriate place for multiple solutions.
Anyone want to talk about future vision? I mean, I was just struck when David put up all those Metropolis-like or Corbusier drawings. It's almost like we need the antithesis or the opposite of that about what the future looks. But in some respects, the future for the United States might look so much different from the future for Istanbul or from Shanghai or from Mumbai. Maybe we should come back to that. I am struck by the conversation here being maybe a domestic possibility.
Frankly,
but with some,
sometimes you need to see, either in a drawing or in another city, you see something and you go, they did it.
Right.
Why can't we do it?
Right. I want one of those.
Yeah, exactly.
Or look what happens if you don't do the right thing.
No, exactly. Yeah. Where is the mic now? Oh, there's the mic. Okay, right over here.
I have a question about the all-weather use of bike lanes, etc. How heavily are the bike lanes used in New York when it's raining versus on a dry day?
Wow, talk about Portland. Talk about rain.
He was taking an example that people could relate to.
Ouch. I look at it, people come out in New York City, certainly. I don't know what happens in Portland. But in New York City, we come out in all sorts of different kinds of weather. And so much like you would not close the parks, and when the weather gets cold, people are still out in parks and people are still biking, even in inclement weather. And again, it does get to that other piece, though, about having indoor bike parking. I think that will go a long way to, keeping that, seeing those numbers continue to grow.
And somebody mentioning showers, which makes a difference to sort of clean up. In Portland, if you didn't bike in the rain, you wouldn't bike. And people don't melt. They make some investment in gear, in certain types of equipment? I mean, the great disc brakes on the Portland model of the bicycle come in handy. But in Helsinki, they've got, you know, little snow tires for their bike. I think that
climate change may
solve the problem. But I do think that is somewhat overstated. It's a matter of equipment. It's a matter of facilities. It's a matter of safety, which comes in even is more important if it's dark and rainy, and maintenance on the part of city crews, understanding how to keep this up with gravel and debris on the right of way.
I want to move to the left here. It's not a political statement.
Right. It's always been.
You've given us a lot of really great examples about how large cities and how cities in general can do better bike parking, better bike infrastructure. And we have seen evidence that there are people moving back into the cities. But my concern is people outside of the cities and the huge number of people who live in suburban or exurban or rural areas. And I think that we maybe are losing those people when we talk about biking as an urban event, because it's not. It's not just an urban event. It could be people in rural areas biking to school with safe routes to school or green routes to work. And I think it's really important to, when we're in meetings like this, but especially in public settings, to talk about the ways that smaller communities or suburban communities can utilize these strategies. For example, having bike parking at the farthest metro stop, you know, in this case, East Falls Church or Fort Totten, so that people can ride their bike to the station and then come in. Or in the DC case, you can't take your bike on the metro at rush hour. Do you know how much that sucks? I mean, it really, really sucks. I mean, like, you can't have a world-class city if you can't take your bike on the infrastructure to get you to work. So I think that some of these things we could talk about in a less urban context, and we would be able to bring more people into the dialogue.
So cycling for metros? Or no, cycling for America, no.
Sounds good.
No, it's not, I mean, Earl, talk about the politics of this, because...
The politics of cycling should be inclusive.
Right.
I mean, all ages, all communities. One of the things that's really, I think, exciting is watching what is happening in terms of bike tourism.
Right.
People are finding that it makes a big difference to be able to have these facilities, to be able to bike Napa Valley. Majority of states now have something like the Rag Bride or Cycle Oregon, which are really... very powerful little engines for small communities and economic development, and be able to showcase communities. But it places a premium on having networks. Bike paths often are easier in some areas where the cost of right-of-way is not so expensive, but we need to do a better job of making sure with federal policy that it's easier to add to the shoulders of these roads so that we're not having suicide situations. I think your point is well taken. I think we're watching this evolve again, but we can do a better job with federal policy, with road design and some of these other policies that I think you're going to see in the new bill. I know you're going to see in the new bill.
Several more questions, because Earl actually has to get back for a vote. So over here.
I just had three quick ideas that somebody might want to run with. One is... I thought of a while back, we have Google Transit and we have MapQuest. Neither of them have bike directions. That might be something to look into.
That's interesting.
The second one is someone mentioned that there was a problem getting approvals because of NEPA requirements that don't really apply to bikes, but they have to address them. Maybe there's somebody that can work on getting an exemption similar to the brownfields, not that they have an exemption, they have an alternate way of conducting NEPA, but somebody could look into that. And third is an idea I had for a business, but I'm not going to do it, but I think it's still a good idea, which is to go around to different businesses, schools, and so forth, and talk to them about creating a brochure or some way that that business can encourage their employees to get to work by alternate means. I know Georgetown University Hospital used to have such a brochure. I thought it was great. I haven't been able to find that at Georgetown University Hospital recently, but it's a great idea for a business, I think, somebody could do.
David, just a question. You've been going around the country giving this performance, talking about the book. Are the questions different in different parts of the country, or is the audience reaction different, or is there some sort of uniform takeaway?
Well, here there's no big surprise. There's a little bit more focus on kind of overall policy, national policy, that kind of thing. Yeah, in general, I did this in a half dozen or so, or maybe it was more, cities here in Canada. And in general, the questions would tend to get directed to the local person who, well, is not the real local person, is not sitting up here tonight, but like somebody in Jeanette's position would get really all the questions. Is like, I want this fixed on my street now.
The American pragmatism just yes. cutting to the chase. Yeah, exactly. Question back here.
Hi, my name is Meredith Began. I'm with the DC Bicycle Advisory Council. I actually have two questions. One was kind of goes back to the question about opposition. I know there was an amendment introduced by Senator McCain that was thankfully shut down. There's the argument that funds shouldn't be going for bicycle facilities because bicyclists don't pay gas tax. So my one question is, how do you respond to that? And then the other one is, I often find a large disconnect between the planners and the engineers. The planners have all these great ideas to include bicycle facilities, and then the engineers say it can't be done. So maybe is that something that needs to happen in the schools that people are going to? Are these like all old school engineers that just aren't in the new thought? Or, yeah.
Let me take the first one. Efforts have been made periodically to strip out funding for enhancements in the transportation bill, and they have been resoundingly defeated. It is the single most popular area of the Surface Transportation Act, where more requests for those evil earmarks for bike and pedestrian facilities than anything else. So I think we have established them as an area that are going to continue. I'm not opposed at all to having a little more investment from the cycling community. We collect, for example, for certain outdoor activities from outdoor equipment, and there's a trust fund that's established. I think doing something for bike tires or equipment, my last bike, I spent more than I spent for my first two cars. This stuff is amazing value. A tiny bit would have some ownership. But every person who cycles, it's just like what was revealed in David's slideshow about the bike parking, where there are 25 bikes for two parking spaces. If you get people off the road on cycling, and you've all seen those great posters. We did one in Portland about how many people it takes to move in cars versus on bikes. It's the most cost-effective way to free up road space. And so in a sense, I could argue for actually paying people to cycle because it would extend the infrastructure. But I think, in fairness, we would be better off if we had a tiny fee on some of our cycling equipment. I think it would give us more leverage.
I can now see how you've been reelected so many times. I want to go all the way in the back. Last couple of questions, because I do want to...
Hello, my name's Frank Whitelock, and I'm from England, and I'd like to thank you for this wonderful seminar. I'd like to just make a comment and a question about how to encourage people who don't cycle, who aren't enthusiasts, to go to work. In Britain for about 2 years now, we've had a central government stimulated program called Cycle to Work, which can be picked up by employers, whereby you can purchase a bike, normally to about £1,000, $1,500, and you pay that back out of your salary over a year, but by some clever games that the government has come up with, you basically get the product for 50%. That's having a really good impact on getting people who don't cycle and have never cycled to cycle to work on good quality machinery. I'm wondering, you mentioned that you would be interested in paying people to cycle, whether that's something you're considering for the next legislation.
Isn't there a law in New York that passed recently where employees get some kind of break? If your employees cycle to work, right, and or in other words, don't use a car to get to work, right, or use public transportation, they get some kind of break, I think. I may have to pay that in my office.
I think that's federal law.
We do have, finally, a bike benefit. We're right, trying to scale it up and, frankly, make it uniform for transit and cycling, and give people a choice about how they use the transit cycling benefit. I think this is an area where we could be much more creative in terms of our marketing. Having a combination bus pass/cycle subsidy/parking, because you can park once a week when you're dealing with the soccer carpool, that you can have a combination of bike and metro. I think working together on packages with the cycling industry for an annual pass that gets you a bike, mm-hmm, and an annual metro pass, and you can use it as you see fit. I think these are a number of ways that we can do a better job marketing, and it'll save money for everybody.
We've got to get Earl back to Capitol Hill. I just want to say that this has been a great panel and a great discussion, and I think in a way what we're seeing are three leaders really in the vanguard of a movement almost. I mean, I think that's what I really took away from what you presented here, David, and from your book. I like the fact that Brookings was shamed. If within a couple months we don't have a bike rack, I don't know what the hell that's going to take. We better do that. I did not steal the bike, by the way, even though I grew up in Brooklyn. I would say that what I heard, I heard a lot of stuff on the supply side. This is Brookings speaking, right? I mean, facilities, infrastructure, how do we make it easier for people to bike? I think the most interesting question here is the cultural change in our society, really across all dimensions, and particularly cities that are outside the dense cities and then in the suburban and exurban communities. I think this cultural issue, and there may be, analogies in our past where we really were able to transform the culture and the behavior of tens of millions of Americans in a particular way. So the supply side, I think, is going to help that. It's going to be the demand side, and this having sort of a viral effect throughout our society. But some closing thoughts. Thank the panelists, and David is available to sign books, I assume, for a period of time. Somewhere back there. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.